Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, October 16, 2015. Obama's endless war continues in Afghanistan. Yesterday, we opened our News and Comment podcast with the announcement from President Obama at the White House that U.S. troop levels at about 9,800 in Afghanistan will stay at that level until some point about the time he leaves office, and then he has authorized a reduction to 55 or 5,800. And the reaction is predictable. Most Americans yawned and said, "Oh, I got a baseball playoff game to watch." And once again, I am disappointed but not surprised. As you've heard me refer to it, this is the whatever war. Whatever Obama says he's going to do, Americans just passively accept it. There is no opposition in Congress from Republicans or Democrats to what by most counts is at least the fifth exit plan that this president has announced since he took office in 2009. He had his surge and then a second surge, and to his credit, he has withdrawn most of the troops. And we declared an end to combat last December with a ceremony. But yesterday's announcement has been met by mostly indifference. And the spin from the White House is the Afghan government has asked us to stay, has invited us in, wants to work with us, and wants to have an enduring partnership. Well, I don't want an enduring partnership with the Afghan government that can't control its own country, can't manage its own military despite $60 or $80 billion that we have spent to train them up. And you heard me cite Andrew Bacevich the other day. This is Vietnamization 2.0. And to its credit, the New York Times published an editorial today on Friday relating most of what I just told you and then offering this opinion. These are optimistic prospects. The most likely scenario might only be to maintain the security status quo for another year. It would be foolish to expect the drawdown delay to turn the war around, nor should this decision become an open-ended commitment that costs American taxpayers billions of dollars and takes Americans' lives each year. The Obama administration and the Pentagon have been disingenuous and at times downright dishonest in their public assessment of the progress American forces and civilians have made in Afghanistan in recent years. The key to ending the Afghan war remains a negotiated truce between the government and the leading factions of the Taliban. It would also require that Afghan leaders take far clearer and bolder steps to root out the country's entrenched corruption and turn a hollow, dysfunctional government into a state that Afghans start to believe in. And unfortunately, I think the Taliban will win this ultimately, and they will return to power in Kabul probably within a year or two. And whether it's 5,500 or 9,800 American troops, we cannot pretend to control that sprawling country, the warlord groups that control certain segments, and the continuing viability of the Taliban opposition. And the only voices who piped up to criticize the president are my friends on the peacenik left. And I'm not diminishing their voices or their courage in any way. But where are the elected officials, Democrats who would have criticized George W. Bush if he made this pronouncement? They are silent. And so David Swanson, who has written a number of books, I've got one right over here called War is a Lie, and he's been an activist on this issue for many years. He put together a statement that has been signed by many leading leftists in this country. He says Obama's decision to leave the actual ending of the war in Afghanistan to his successor, illustrates our collective and his personal failure to overcome what candidate Obama once called the mindset that gets us into wars. The idea that year 15 or year 16 is going to go better in Afghanistan than the first 14 years is based on no evidence whatsoever. And he notes that the longest ever U.S. war since the destruction of the people who were here when we got here, referring to Native Americans, is far more President Obama's war than President Bush's. Yet Obama has been given credit for ending it without actually ending it for nearly 7 years. And that is a fair statement. Then this statement cites a number of sources, including U.S. Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who quit as the head of the Pentagon's DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. He says, the more weapons we give, the more bombs we drop. That just fuels the conflict. The CIA, which finds its own drone program counterproductive. Admiral Dennis Blair, former director of national intelligence. While drone attacks did help reduce the Qaeda leadership in Pakistan, they also increased hatred of America. And this statement continues, the airstrikes in the Kunduz hospital have generated more attention than many other U.S. atrocities committed in Afghanistan. Yet horrific attacks have been the mainstay of this war, which was begun illegally and without U.N. authorization. And the statement closes with three powerful words, end it now. It's signed by Swanson, by Medea Benjamin, by Colonel Ann Wright, Matthew Ho, former embassy officer in Iraq, and a number of other people who have been on the forefront of the peace movement in this country for many years. And I'm going to put up a link to this statement so you can read it, and I hope you'll embrace it, lend your voice to an effort to end this madness. Gareth Porter, a frequent contributor to this podcast, has published a new report at Truth Out today. And the headline reads, the U.S. could end Saudi war crimes in Yemen. It just doesn't want to. And he notes that the Saudi-led coalition is guilty of systematic war crimes, but the U.S. is unwilling to use its leverage to stop the Saudi carnage. On October 6, Amnesty International released a report which openly declared Saudi policy of deliberately targeting two Yemeni cities as violation of the laws of war. The report cited a public declaration by a Saudi military spokesman on May 8th that essentially civilians should leave because we're going to attack these towns. These are clear violations of the international laws of war. The Saudis have also imposed a tight blockade on Yemen by air and sea, which exacerbates the humanitarian crisis there. And the Amnesty report points out that the U.S. has a legal obligation under the Arms Trade Treaty not to provide weaponry it knows will be used in the indiscriminate bombing of Yemen. Article 6 of that treaty, which took effect in October of 2014, forbids the transfer of arms and munitions to a party to an armed conflict if it has knowledge that that will be used for attacks directed against civilians. And the United States, while it occasionally hems and haws about the loss of civilian life in Yemen, has taken no steps to restrain our nominal allies, the Saudis. Today I'm releasing to our subscribers a powerful, fresh interview with Max Blumenthal. He wrote the book Goliath, which is quite an expose of the Israeli approach to the Palestinian neighbors. And as we have seen in recent days, Israel is increasingly using propaganda to shift the blame, to create the sense that Israel is the victim here. And our media aids and abets the Israeli propaganda operation in great detail. Max Blumenthal is quite outspoken. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with him today.
Everyone who's listening should see the video of Ahmed Manasra after he was shot and he apparently attempted a stabbing attack or carried one out that wounded an Israeli. He's 13 years old, and you wonder what drives a 13-year-old to commit an attack where he is likely to be shot. The Israeli opposition leader, Yair Lapid, is called on Israelis to shoot anyone who pulls out a screwdriver. Palestinians are being beaten and attacked for suspected by people who suspect they have knives, even when they don't. Jews who look like Arabs have been stabbed and beaten twice already by Israelis. Mm-hmm. So there's just what leads a kid to do this? This is a kid who was doomed, determined that he had no future, and wanted to lash out. Someone who didn't want to live his life in a settler colonial reality where he's the colonial subject. And so he goes on a stabbing attack. He's shot and it falls in a hail of bullets. And he's videotaped lying on the ground with kind of his body folded in a really unusual pose. His eyes are rolled back into his head and blood is seeming to pour from his head. And an Israeli man is standing over him shouting, "Give him another bullet. I hope you die, you son of a bitch." While he's filming the boy, apparently dying. It turns out that Manasra lived. He was taken to an Israeli hospital. And the Israelis recognized this is a really good propaganda opportunity because this kid's going to live. He's tried to stab someone without provocation in their minds. So they photographed him getting good food, being in a hospital. He's handcuffed to the bed, but he's getting the best medical care, and all the Israeli newspapers and media are having a field day with this. And then along comes a bus who is completely out of touch with his own people, who's unelected. He's an emergency president who's been installed by Israel in the U.S. And Abbas, in his speech, he appears after days and days of silence, gives a really short and incoherent speech, and he refers to Manasra as a martyr or someone who's been executed by the Israeli police. It turns out he's alive, and so Netanyahu seizes on it to attack Abbas. The Israeli media's field day continues, and Palestinians, just regular Palestinians, saw this as another example of how out of touch Abbas was, that he didn't know the condition of someone who is probably one of the most visible attackers in these series of attacks in Jerusalem, mainly because of his, the pathetic and disgusting outcome of the attack that was filmed.
You can hear the full interview with Max Blumenthal about his new book, The 51-Day War, and about the current situation in the Middle East. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And speaking of subscribers, let me thank Marianne Razzo and also many others who support me, Joey Perillo, Mark Lewis. They are subscribers who believe in what we're doing here and support it, and I invite you to lend a hand. I need more subscribers. I need more listeners right now. So please come over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab in the upper right corner, then click on Become a Subscriber, and it's easy from there to follow the directions, and takes about 5 minutes. If you're allergic to PayPal, no worries. You can send me a check or money order, a one-time contribution, or for a subscription. And don't forget, we have the Zippy New app for iPads and iPhones that's available in the Apple App Store. One of the things I discuss in detail with Max Blumenthal in our in-depth interview is an event of recent days where a Palestinian 13-year-old boy, whose name is Ahmad Manasra, was apparently attempting to stab an Israeli, and he was shot. The leader of the Palestinians, the Fatah movement, Mahmoud Abbas, was out of touch, according to Blumenthal, and relied on a video that made it look like the young boy had died. And so Abbas went public and accused Israel of stabbing to death, executing an innocent Palestinian boy. And this created the propaganda opening for the Netanyahu government and the prime minister himself to then brand this a big lie. But we know that many teens and children have been shot and killed, some summarily executed, and adults in similar situations. And so the conflict is continuing in this particular episode, and I really value the views that Max Blumenthal shared with us in our in-depth interview podcast today. There's another incident reported this morning in the West Bank, where we're told that dozens of Palestinians set fire to a holy site known as Joseph's Tomb. Now, it is hard by a Palestinian refugee camp, and this violence, has occurred, and it is deplored by the Palestinian Authority. We also have an incident that occurred in Hebron yesterday, where a Palestinian man posing as a news photographer stabbed an Israeli soldier. The soldier survived, but others shot and killed the assailant. And this could lead to further attacks on members of the press who have already filed a protest for questionable actions by the Israelis in the first 2 weeks or so of October. In the Democratic debate the other night, we know that Bernie Sanders came to the rescue of Hillary Clinton. The damsel was in distress because Anderson Cooper was asking her about her emails, the private server, and all that stuff. Well, members of the FBI who are charged with investigating the Clinton server and whether or not it was compromised, hacked, while she was Secretary of State, are reportedly steaming at comments that the president made on 60 Minutes this past Sunday night. He said while it was a mistake for Hillary to use a private email account, he said, "This is not a situation in which America's national security was endangered." Well, this is seen by investigators as tipping the scales in favor of the former Secretary of State, and that this is an effort to inject politics to try to pressure the investigators to return a report that is similar to the president's view. And I understand. As you know, I believe that these emails are not a trivial issue. It's not a gotcha game. I think that they reveal the cronyism of Bill and Hillary Clinton, the improper connections between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department while Hillary was running it. And I believe that these emails will ultimately expose problems that bring down the Clinton candidacy. And I'm even willing to predict that by March or so of next year, after at least at this point it appears Sanders will win in Iowa and New Hampshire, that the compound problems faced by that campaign will lead to her exit. And I've told a number of people this view of mine, including my brother and his family the other night, and there are a lot of people who simply can't accept that idea. They think that Hillary's in for the long haul, that the debate the other night burnished her credentials, shored up her support. And I think it's fascinating to see that we have such a wide range of reactions to who won the debate. And we know, for example, that in non-scientific online polls where people just go and say, "I support so-and-so," that Sanders won in virtually every venue. Now, in the scientific polls, we can see that Hillary maintains a strong lead among likely voters nationally. But her support has been dropping over time. And a new poll that is not of likely voters, so it's not as accurate as others. It's of people who say they watched the debate. It was conducted by Google among 800 respondents nationally. Shows Bernie Sanders in the lead over Hillary Clinton. Now, all of these are just snapshots, and I want to be clear that these expressions online, when people go to their favorite website and click on "I support Bernie Sanders," those are not scientific. But they do show a lot of enthusiasm for his candidacy, and that following the debate, that's the energy that people were attracted to. And I think what it really shows is a huge gap between the pundit class, that thinks that Hillary is a lock, that she's entitled to it, Sanders can't touch her. I saw Nate Silver and his pals today kind of just laughing at Sanders and saying that, you know, there's no way Hillary can lose. And as you know, I don't buy that. One of the factors that could be resolved before I speak to you again on Monday is Joe Biden. And while I would not support Joe Biden, if he enters the race, he's going to draw voters from Hillary Clinton, not from Bernie Sanders. And so the dynamics are very interesting, but because of Hillary's negatives, because everybody knows who she is, she has very little room for growth. Sanders doesn't have that problem. And now allies of Hillary are circulating petitions urging Joe Biden to stay out of the race. That shows that they are very concerned about who would be hurt if he enters. I want to thank listener Mike Lamb. He emailed me yesterday to correct a comment I made after we heard that the final negotiations had been completed for the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. And at the time, I said that the American public would get to review this draft agreement, which has all been done in secret, in about 30 days. But it appears I was wrong. And that while the elected officials in the Congress, the House and the Senate, will now be permitted to review the text of the draft Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, the plan is to keep it secret and out of the view of the general public for 4 more years. Now, I'm very outraged by this. I want to thank Mike for correcting me on it. And now I want you to take that information and call your senator or member of Congress and howl at them. Tell them this is unacceptable. We can't allow the Congress to pass a secret deal that we won't even know the contents of for 4 more years? That's incredible. All week I've been saving some stories about immigration that really cause grave concern. From The Guardian on Monday, the 12th of October, the U.S. government is deporting undocumented immigrants back to Central America to face the imminent threat of violence, with several individuals being murdered just days or months after their return. Now, you know, we had this wave of immigration last summer, including a lot of people, children, teenagers, unaccompanied by adults, many of them fleeing violence in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Well, according to The Guardian, as many as 83 individuals who got into the United States and then were deported back to their native countries have been killed since 2014. And some of the stories are chilling of people who returned and within days they were attacked by gangs and killed. Here's a story of 3 young Honduran men who were killed all soon after deportation. 2 of them had originally fled to the U.S. after their brothers were violently attacked by gangs. And so while the Republicans are having their little racist and ugly conversation, if you want to call it that, about immigration, the Obama administration has deported more people than most of the administrations before it, if I have my facts correct. And now we see that despite the clear violence and threat of death that immigrants from those 3 countries face, that we continue to send them back. And in Sunday's New York Times, this past Sunday, Sonia Nazario, the author of Enrique's Journey, published a story that concludes we are paying Mexico to keep people from reaching our border. The U.S. government is sponsoring the hunting of migrants in Mexico to prevent them from reaching the U.S. It's forcing them to go back to El Salvador, Honduras, to their deaths. So this is being reported in more than one place. And yet we don't hear any comment about it from our elected officials. Meanwhile, the ACLU has published a report regarding the Border Patrol and its operations both at the border and on the other side in Mexico. And they say that federal checkpoints on highways near the Mexican border with trained dogs, expensive scanning equipment, are supposed to stop drugs and immigrants without legal status from heading north. But the troubling picture that's developing between agents and many of those that they stop and search is raising concerns. So the documents detail encounters between motorists and border agents from January 2011 to August 2014. They portray an agency whose fractured oversight system has enabled at least some agents working along the southern border to stretch the limits of law and professional courtesy while rarely facing meaningful consequences. Among the 142 complaints obtained by the ACLU, only one seems to have resulted in disciplinary action. And since January 1st of 2010, 33 people have died in encounters with border agents and customs agents, but only one of those agents has been taken to court. And finally, today, here in parched California, after 3 hard years of drought, we're getting encouraging reports from the forecasters that El Nino is going to bring a rich bounty of rain to California this winter. Now, I'm hoping it doesn't happen real soon because I have an open trench at my house as we try to seal up the foundation in preparation for a downpour. But just yesterday, flash flooding sent water, mud, and rocks rushing across Interstate 5 north of Los Angeles after a rainstorm hitting the very dry earth produced this kind of instant flooding. And I don't know that this is predictive of what might occur if we get the full force of El Nino that is predicted, but it's something we'll have to worry about. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. Be sure to catch the Max Blumenthal interview. And you're always welcome to send me your comments and feedback. My email is peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.